Webcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, Director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602. Or toll-free across the United States, it's 1-877-753-3341. And now, with today's topic, here is James White.
And welcome to The Dividing Line, live from London, England. I am hearing the oddest sound over this connection. It honestly sounds very much like a death metal band singer. As soon as the music started, I thought somebody had hacked our system and recorded some satanic message over top of the beginning of The Dividing Line. I'm like, oh, this is going to be an interesting... It's been an interesting trip so far. There's no two ways about it. My luggage has not yet arrived, and I arrived yesterday morning. So it's been quite the interesting experience so far. No two ways about it. It was one of those things where the first leg of your trip ends up being an hour longer than it was supposed to be because they routed us. I sort of got to visit all the United States on the way from Phoenix to Philadelphia down near Georgia and everything else to avoid the weather. And so you get in late, you go running over to the international gates, and you're one of the last people on the plane. And who sits down in the row in front of you but two ladies with babies, one of whom has an earache. And you're now going to try to sleep for 8 hours on the trip over to London, and that's not going to happen. So, and then you get there, and you stand there at that wonderful luggage machine, and as you see more and more people walking away, you start feeling ever more lonely until the machine stops and your luggage isn't there. But, you know, that's just sort of how things go. And we did have an opportunity last night to do a television program that honestly we really didn't know exactly what to expect until it started, basically. And there were three of us on a panel, a black pastor by the name of Edward Bwama, and then Dr. Tony Lane from London. Is it School of Theology now, LST? I think it's London School of Theology. It's London School of Theology because he gave LST in his email address. And he's written a number of books on Calvin and issues like that. And then myself, and I guess what had happened is there had been a segment where predestination had been discussed on this program, and or at least had come up. And so there were so many questions about it, they decided to have a program to discuss it. And that's what we did for the first hour. And then Dr. Lane had to leave, and so the pastor and I stayed for the second hour. So we did 2 hours, and it was taking live emails as they were coming in and live phone calls. And some of those phone calls were quite interesting. One got into Israel and predestination and eschatology, and I was going, if he had turned to us with the Israel question, I was going to pat the pastor on the back and say, you haven't gotten to say quite as much as you'd like so far. How about you taking that? But he didn't even bother to throw it our direction. So it was quite the interesting experience. But we had to travel through London to get to the location of the television studios. And at rush hour, basically. So it was quite the interesting trip through London across the Thames, and we went right past the Eye of London, which I didn't realize that goes around once every half hour, I believe. If you've never been to London, it's not fair to call it a Ferris wheel, but it's very similar, except it moves very, very slowly. And I understand they even do weddings. As long as you can get it done in half an hour, you can do weddings looking over the that's fairly close to Parliament and things like that. So it's right downtown where you can see Big Ben and stuff like that, yeah. So I saw that we were moving so slowly to traffic, I was able to actually see it moving. So that's how I figured out that it went around at a certain point in time. But coming back, though, we were able to take the M25, which is the route that basically circles all of London. And it was raining, and I've not quite figured out yet whether I was in a car or a low-flying aircraft. Sometimes it partook of both. But I was so tired that it really didn't matter one way or the other at that point in time, and because I had been traveling for, 18 hours or something like that, and had almost no sleep and didn't have any of my own clothes. And I'm just hoping that everything I said was, in fact, orthodox. I didn't hear anything afterwards that gave well, unfortunately, yes. I'm not necessarily certain that that would have been detected one way or the other, but we had some friends there. I think they might have noticed something outrageously out of the way. But anyway, we had a good time on the program, and hopefully some folks were edified by that. We had a Jehovah's Witness call in, and he called in because another woman had called in and had raised the Israel issue and had attacked London School of Theology for not being all premillennial. And she got cut off pretty quickly. So the Jehovah's Witness called in to defend the idea of not being premillennial. It's like, well, how do we change this topic into something worthwhile? And so I launched into something about, I forget how I got into who Christ was. And, you know, I tried to transition into something that was meaningful in witnessing to a Jehovah's Witness. And it was just very interesting, the number of calls that we got and the directions that they went. It was quite interesting. I guess according to people in the channel, I'm sounding far too happy. I guess when you're in London, you're supposed to be straight laced and and very glum and things like that. So I'll try to be less happy in the rest of the program as we possibly can. But tomorrow, Lord willing, a piece of luggage will be delivered here. And that way I'll be able to utilize my computer again, since I'm slowly killing the batteries that I had brought with me. And have learned a lesson. Put a few things that you need the first couple days in your carry-on rather than the other one in case it does not arrive with you. Or who knows where it was sent. It would be interesting to be able to track which airports it ended up going through if we just got lost in Philadelphia. Going through Philadelphia, sorry to Spidey Geek, but going through Philadelphia is a very frightening thing. So I guess we do have some birthdays in channel. I don't want to even try to sing happy birthday to anyone, but Rosie and I don't think that Sheffy is actually a proper pronunciation of that term, but looks like we have some ladies who are celebrating getting younger today in channel, so we say happy birthday to them as well. Yes, we do have the All British Dividing Line today, and if you would like to call in and request a British accent, it must be accompanied with a proper donation to the ministry. But 877-753-3341. I do not have that number. Well, there it is. It's at the top of the channel thing. That's good. I do need that.
No donation is large enough for that.
No donation is large enough.
Yeah, it can't be done.
Well, now, why is that, Rich? I mean, don't you know the old saying that when in London, do as the Londoners do?
I had not heard that.
You had not heard that one? Well, I know that the Italians think they have copyright on that, but it actually came from London. So, I could use everyone's
help.
Let
me just remind you about a certain politician on this side of the pond who likes to change.
Use fake accent.
Yes, in order to blend in with their audience. Anything
well,
I can do to dissuade you.
No, we can't discuss politics on the dividing line. That's I'm certain we'll get sued by someone if we do. And I wouldn't know who you were talking about.
Of course not.
No one would ever do that.
No one would ever
pretend that they were something that they were not. That would just never happen. But I did hear that the Suns had a game stolen from them, and that the big question right now in Phoenix is how much San Antonio buy Stern for, and can we top them for the next
game? It's not just in Phoenix. It's all over the sports nationally. A lot of sports people are very, very angry with David Stern.
From what I've seen, it's the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen in my life. Just unbelievable.
It's tantamount to fixing a game.
Definitely going to reward dirty play, but anyway.
Yeah. Anyway,
let's not get into that.
Back to our primary topics here.
No, not exactly. Not exactly. Well, do let me know. I will be able to see your little thing start blinking here on my screen. Should someone assist us at the program today at 877-753-3341. I have been taking some time to be looking about the net and picked up some interesting stories. I think one of the reasons that we closed the window was so no one passing by would hear me talking about Islam here in London, because I'm not certain that that's actually legal. Making sure it's... Oh, now he's opening all the windows. Okay. Don't mind having a little breeze through there, actually, but be that as it may. I was looking at the Christianity Today article that was linked to by Jeff Downs on our website, where it says Christians in Karsada, a town in northwest frontier province in Pakistan, have been warned that if they do not convert to Islam by today, 17 May, which for people outside the United States is an appropriate means of indicating the date, we would say May 17th, but we're sort of backwards to the rest of the world, they will face dire consequences and bomb explosions. That's obviously a difficult way of translating that in English. Christianity Today has learned the threats were made in a letter circulated last week to the town's Christian population, according to the All Pakistan Minorities Alliance. And so here you have believers. Some of you may recall the program that we did, interestingly enough, interviewing a man that we called Peter, who was here in London, actually, at the time. A man who was converted to Christ by the reading of the New Testament, a New Testament that had been left with his father there in the borderland between Pakistan and Afghanistan. And it was the reading of that text that converted him to Christ. And those who are converted to Christ in that area face a tremendous difficulty. And certainly it's one of the things I'll never forget about the interview with Peter was the statement that he made, that he, having only a familiarity with what the Quran teaches, when he read the New Testament to hear Christ's own teachings, was a complete revelation to him. And as I have since then become more and more familiar with the Quran, there's no question whatsoever. I heard a quotation, and I need to track down the actual source of the quotation so I can properly credit the man who said it. He is a liberal Islamic scholar, which means he could not live in a number of nations on this earth, when you think about that for a moment. I think that says something. But a liberal Islamic scholar has said the Jesus of the Quran is an argument, not a person. And he is an argument for the prophethood of Muhammad. And I am reading through the Quran again, but this time I'm reading through it in a chronological reading, that is, from the earliest surahs to the last surahs, as best you can. Some surahs are somewhat mixed, and there is question among scholars as to exactly how to order this material. But it is interesting to see the first appearances of Isa, of the Christ, the Messiah, in the Quran. And the fact that he is a contextless, ahistorical argument in favor of Muhammad as a prophet. He's not talking about himself. He's not talking about... just completely different than what you find in the New Testament. And so it certainly is understandable how someone, if all they've ever heard has been a recitation or a rephrasing of the very... a small amount of material in the Quran about Jesus, to read the New Testament is an incredible thing. But I have met so few Muslims who have, despite the fact that the Quran speaks of the gospel. They have been told by their leaders so often that gospel has been robbed from the Bible. It's been taken from the Bible. that they don't bother to read the New Testament. And if they do, then of course they're faced with a decision. Either they have to reject this entire book because it's so different from the Quran, no one could possibly put the two together, or they must abandon Muhammad as a prophet. There is really no way of putting the two together. And so here we have Christians in Kharsada, and I have not seen any discussion of whether this has taken place or anything else. The fact of the matter is Pakistan. In fact, it's in the same story. It's in the same story. Let me read you. they started talking about the fact that there had been a Mr. Bandara, who is Parsi, who had attempted to bring into Pakistan's National Assembly a modification of what's known as 295C of the Pakistan Penal Code. If you keep up with Voice of the Martyrs, and you've heard me saying much more about this, you cannot study Islam without constantly being encountering the fact that Muslims persecute Christians all around the world. It is a part of those nations that become Islamic nations to persecute Christians, to have the capital sentences for those who convert to another religion and things like this. And as you read about what has taken place in these nations, you see that when a particular nation has a blasphemy law, as Pakistan does, then the means of persecuting the Christians basically becomes accusing someone, whether falsely or truly, of blaspheming Muhammad. Well, how would you define blaspheming Muhammad? I mean, it's very easy to determine the blasphemies that take place daily against Jesus Christ, but if you're a Christian and someone asks you the question, do you believe Muhammad was a prophet? And you say, no, I do not believe he was, then that's easily interpreted as being a blasphemy of the prophet. And so to have that kind of a law on the books is in essence to say, this is an Islamic country that is not open to anyone else living within it. And so very often when you read the stories of false imprisonments and false accusations, they are based upon these blasphemy laws. Well, this Mr. Bandara had attempted to bring into the National Assembly a modification and a change in reference to these particular laws, and in particular, if you're an atheist in Pakistan, I think you probably would keep that to yourself, to be sure. He wanted to have a modification of the blasphemy laws, and here's what the article says. It says, his proposals were greeted with cries of shame from government and opposition benches and were rejected by the parliamentary affairs minister as un-Islamic. Quote, Islam is our religion and such bills hurt our feelings. This is not a secular state, but the Islamic Republic of Pakistan. The hurt our feelings part definitely leaves me going, excuse me? okay, if you're the Islamic Republic of Pakistan, fine, that's one thing, but please, hurt our feelings is a little bit difficult to stomach at that point. But this is what is going on all over the world in these nations, and it is many, many innocent Christians this day are separated from their families, and if you go back on the blog, I spent some time preaching on this particular subject a few weeks ago at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church, and I would direct you to that. As I was reading this, it was brought to my attention a large article in the Daily Mail, which is a major news publication, news journal, there's a plain newspaper here in London, and it's a large center point here, page 42 and 40. That's odd, 42 through 47. I guess there was something in between them. Anyway, Stoned to Death for Love. It is the story of a Dua Khalil Aswad, a 17-year-old, very pretty young lady. I guess, and I did not do so, nor would I really want to, but I guess you can go online and watch the video of her being stoned to death in Iraq, up near Mosul. And she was stoned and killed for having fallen in love with a Sunni boy. And she is not Sunni. She is a part of a religion that I will confess, until this afternoon, I had never heard of before in my life. She is a part of the Yazidi religion. I looked it up online. It's either Yazidi or Yazidi. And this is a form of ancient Gnosticism with certain elements of Islam involved. Mosul is the center point of about 500,000 people who follow this particular religion. And when she fell in love with a Sunni boy, then a death sentence was issued out for her, and she was publicly stoned over the course of about half an hour. I guess it was just incredibly brutal. And this is just takes place in the streets of these places. And I looked up the Yazidi religion online, and it was quite fascinating. Again, if you are familiar with the Book of Colossians and 1 John, you would find a number of parallels to the situation. They have, in essence, the heavenly beings. They don't worship actually the God who created all things. They worship a lesser being that is in charge of this world, called Melek Taus. Yazidi accounts of creation differ from that of Christianity. Islam, they believe that God first created Melek Taus from his own illumination, and the other six archangels were created later on. God ordered Melek Taus not to bow to other beings, and God created the other archangels, which, interestingly enough, not only would that be Gnostic, the emanations and things like that, but that sounds a little bit like Jehovah's Witnesses. I mean, when you think about it, the first thing God creates, and the only thing God creates directly, is Michael the Archangel. An archangel. And it's one of the reasons I've frequently said to those who defend the Jehovah's Witness reading of Colossians chapter 1, you are in essence arguing for the very position that was being argued against by the Apostle Paul. You're turning his own apologetic on its head. So anyway, these folks are still around. There are still, in essence, Gnostic religions in the world, and here is a situation where the followers of this religion killed one of those that fell in love with a Sunni Muslim boy, who I don't, no one knows who he is or anything like that. But that's a sad story. She's a very pretty young girl, and that's the situation that goes on in those places. Now, of course. As everyone recognized, yesterday, Jerry Falwell passed away, and I'm starting to become somewhat concerned about going to the airport, because the last time that I went to the airport to go overseas, or one of the recent times that I went to the airport to go overseas, the situation with Terri Schiavo took place, and she passed away while I was in the waiting area. Well, I get to the waiting area at the airport, and breaking news, Jerry Falwell has been taken to the hospital gravely ill. And so I'm like, okay, well, I should stop going to the airport because this is not a good thing. And given his health history, when the initial comments, the initial report came across, I had a feeling what we were going to hear, and of course that is what eventually ended up being the situation. So, yeah, day before yesterday. It's yesterday for me. Yesterday was approximately 36 to 40 hours in length. So just, you know, just scratch off, you know, it's 7 o'clock at night, but on what day, I don't know. Here, so I just crammed all of 2 days into one day, and so, you know, whatever, quit picking on me. So anyhow, obviously I extended my condolences as best I could on my BlackBerry from the waiting area itself, and It is sad to see some of the responses that have come out. I noticed that the gays and lesbians held an anti-memorial for Jerry Falwell in San Francisco. Now, the irony is that they don't bother saying how many people showed up. I guess when you are a part of the, you're a homosexual in San Francisco, all you got to do is call a newspaper and say that you're going to have an anti-memorial, and it doesn't really matter if anybody shows up. Now, if Christians do something, if Christians want to make a public statement, then you have to have 10,000 people show up, and they'll report it as 2,000, and it'll be on the, you know, third page of the seventh section of the newspaper. But as long as you're a homosexual in San Francisco, you have super rights, and so they have this this anti-Jerry Falwell memorial. And no one will talk about the hatred, you know, the fact that this would qualify as a hate crime if it was a non-homosexual. If it was a Fred Phelps type, they would be talking about hate crimes. But as long as you're a homosexual, you can't commit hate crimes. You can only be the object of hate crimes. You can't commit them. Even though I was looking at a story online, just a terrible story, of the murder of two individuals back in, I believe, January, that has simply been just, they won't cover it in the mainstream media because it's not a politically correct a crime. And so you just, the inconsistencies of journalism in our world today are just terrible. 877-753-3341 is the phone number. Yes, if you would like to speculate on who's going to be in charge of Liberty University next, I suppose you can do that. Obviously, that's been a question in everyone's mind, but I have no special insights into such things, and we'll be monitoring events just like anybody else will be, for that matter. But I honestly have no concept of where the university is going to go. Obviously, Ergun Canner is a well-known person there, but Ergun Canner is likewise very much an unliked person by many other people. And so will there be a political battle? I don't know. It would be sad if there was, but the fact is that that's the kind of world we live in, so I have no way of knowing. But it will be very, very interesting to see what takes place in that a particular way. There was a another article, since we were talking about quote-unquote hate crimes, and the passage of the House representatives of the bill regarding hate crimes of 237 to 180. That's the bill that I believe President Bush has promised to veto. So we have at least about 18 more months worth of safety from that one. But this whole issue of hate crimes and this whole issue of trying to discern the intentions of people's hearts rather than being a nation of laws, where it is the law that is looked to, not to some psychological examination of why people did what they did, that has been used in Europe, in Australia, in Canada, as the means of intimidating people into silence, of making people worried that when they open their mouth and they speak what they believe to be truth, that when they do so, they will have to pay for so doing. And certainly minority groups, especially homosexuals, but abortion rights advocates, want to make people very concerned about what they say in an attempt to intimidate those who would speak about them. And it's coming to the United States. It's just coming a little bit more slowly than it has in other places. People won't bother to look and see the effects elsewhere, but that's what's taking place. Now, over here in the UK, it's a little bit of a gray day here. It's just shocking that there would ever be a gray day in London. I mean, I just expected the bright blue skies and sunshine and everything else, but it's a little bit of a gray, overcast day here in Enfield, which is the northwest, east. Just straight north, okay, north of downtown London. And nice breeze as I'm looking at my, actually it's not my computer, it's Roger's computer, but looking at my Google homepage, I see that it's 93.2 degrees back in Phoenix, and it's not going to be 93 degrees here probably for, does it get up to 93, 95? Doesn't get that hot here. Okay, well, so it's already warmer back at home than it could ever be here. And I don't even know what the temperature is here. I guess I should have put that in to figure out what the temp is, but it's low 60s. Yeah, it's around 60 degrees. Of course, I'm not using the centigrade thing there. But, you saw some speculation that the Falwell Sun was taking. Well, maybe so. That would be interesting. But anyway, it's nice here. And as I was looking for material on the program, since no one has bothered to be kind enough so far, even all those folks in the chat channel who are busily chatting with one another, but they won't pick up the phone. And they won't assist me in the all-British dividing line today. Excuse me while I try to recover here. My good friend Roger has a question for me. And now I just need to mention to Rich, you cannot complain about the fact that he has a British accent because he lives in London. So this is for real. He's not... He's the one who's mentioned to me that I sound like Dick Van Dyke when I try to do a British accent. But actually, we do have a question, and so I'm going to be passing the phone off here to my brother Roger, and then I will do my best to answer it. Of course, it could be a very difficult question. I may have to take a break to figure it out, but hold on just a moment.
Yes, Dr. Weiss, it's obvious you're a Calvinist. But over here in England, we want to know, the burning question is, are you a self-respecting Calvinist?
Well, Roger, I don't know what you could possibly be referring to, unless possibly you're referring to the fact that every self-respecting Calvinist is a premillennialist. Is that what you're asking about? You're going to try to get me in trouble here, aren't you? Oh, my. I see Rich has a... good. All right, we do have a call coming in, which doesn't mean I'm going to ignore your question, but so evidently a certain beginning sermon at the recent Shepherds Conference has made it all the way across the pond a little bit, and has left you just as befuddled as it left everyone else, didn't it? No, I guess I'm not a self-respecting Calvinist. I can say, well, you're going to say, it's easy to get rid of me without any luggage anyways, you know? Just throw your tablet out the window and you're ready to go. Yes, indeed. So some of you know what I'm talking about. Some of you have no idea what I'm talking about. And unfortunately, those of you who do know what I'm talking about are probably getting me in trouble for having said what I said. But no, I am not a self-respecting Calvinist at that particular point in time. But wait a minute. Now, people are picking on my British accent. I haven't even used it. That was you, and you're British. That's good. Well, anyway. All right. We actually do have a phone call, and I appreciate that. And up from it's where I was born. I was born in Minnesota, but I don't call it my homeland because my ancestors came from Scotland, of course. So, I was born up in Minnesota, and so let's talk to Kyron up in Minnesota. Hello, Kyron.
Hey, how you doing, Doc? This is Kyron here.
I'm doing pretty well given the circumstances of the traveling out here and everything else, so we're...
Are you over there trying to stir up the Scottish? I hear that Sean Connery may come home if the right party wins.
Sean Connery might come home if the right
yeah,
party
he,
wins.
Yeah, I read in one of the papers that the Scots may get their next...
some more fake Russian accents for us.
Listen, I was wanting to know, I'm doing some study on Mormonism, and I was wanting to know how the Mormons deal with the word everlasting in, like, Psalms or the Isaiah passages where God dwells or inhabits eternity. And right. I was kind of curious as to, since they don't believe that God has an eternity, they must somehow look at these verses some way. Can you tell me how?
Yeah, actually, if you look up the term in the Doctrine and Covenants, you will see... let me back up. For people... I wanted to start posting, and I wanted to have queued up to post on the blog while I was gone an entire introductory segment on the Mormon doctrine of God, because obviously with Mitt Romney's run for the presidency, there is a heightened interest in the theology of Mormonism, and it comes at an interesting time where Mormonism is struggling to really be very consistent in its own definition of its own theology. Mormonism is undergoing a lot of stresses and strains right now. Their numbers are down, their numbers are weak as far as their proselytization, pretty much just natural growth rather than the huge explosion that they had in the 1970s and 80s into the early 90s. And there's confusion on the leadership of the church as to what direction they're to go. It used to be that Mormonism was very, very clear in not defining itself as a Christian faith in the sense of just being one of many. But because they've been trying to mainstream, a lot of their own people are now confused as to what is really central in their theology and what is not. The doctrine of God, which of course is what you're looking at there, is part and parcel of where there is a lot of confusion now, not because there's been some official repudiation of what Mormonism has taught in the past, but through a less consistent emphasis upon what used to be what even the youngest Mormons were taught. When I first went out to Salt Lake, to Mesa, and began witnessing the Mormons back when I myself was about the same age as the missionaries, you could talk to young Mormon guys, 12, 13 years old, who would be able to give you a really clear definition of what Mormons believe. Now you can talk to 25-year-olds out there, and you have to bring out your LDS scriptures and your other works to even explain to them the concept of exaltation to godhood and things like that. There's been a tremendous change over that period of time. But again, not that the church has changed its teaching. So the same thing is true of the Doctrine and Covenants, in a sense. When you go to the Doctrine and Covenants, or the Book of Mormon, for example, we'll use everlasting in pretty much the same way you and I would, because you need to remember when Joseph Smith wrote the Book of Mormon, he had not yet developed the concept of the plurality of gods.
Yes.
And so that terminology and that language you'll find in the Book of Mormon is drawn directly from his experiences in Methodism and Presbyterianism, and is very much in a biblical sense at that point. Then when you get into Doctrine and Covenants, the earlier revelations are going to be along the same line because they're contemporaneous with the period of the writing of the Book of Mormon and immediately thereafter. Then when you get into the middle 1830s, this is when Joseph's theology begins to change, and you start getting these odd redefinitions of words. For example, and this is directly relevant to your question, when you talk to a Mormon and you use the term everlasting life. Now, for you and I, anyone who's familiar with the Bible, there's a fairly obvious meaning to that kind of terminology, and we would share that in common. But when you read LDS writings, you discover that in their mind there's a subtle redefinition to where it's everlasting lives, L-I-V-E-S. And instead of it referring to a kind of life that is never-ending that is given to us by God as part of salvation, in the Mormon concept, everlasting lives is the ability on the part of an exalted man to produce offspring with his wives so that he can have celestial children. See, once everybody who goes to heaven in Mormonism, except those who are exalted to godhood, so even Mormons who go to the celestial kingdom, but they were not married during the eternal marriage ceremony and hence will become angels, even they and everyone below them are said to be damned. But here's another place where the term has two different meanings. Not damned in the sense that you and I would use that, but damned as in damned up and unable to finish their progression to their fullest extent. It is only those at the top who become exalted who have the ability to have spirit children, and that is one of the two definitions of God, the power of the priesthood and the power of procreation. So eternal lives is the ability to give life to procreate spiritual children in the pre-existence, populate a planet, and then become the god of that planet, worshipped by those who are on that planet. So you can see that there's a massively different lexicon being used by the Mormons than is used by Christians at this point. So when they talk about God, and they encounter these texts that talk about God being everlasting, omnipresent, having all knowledge, older Mormons, the Mormons who would be more consistent with Joseph Smith, more consistent with Utah Mormonism, let's put it that way, will interpret that in the sense of in reference to this creation.
Okay.
And so when you go to Colossians 1, you talk about how Jesus Christ created all things, were in heaven, earth, visible, invisible, so on and so forth. They say, yes, Jesus is the creator of this world. The Bible is only relevant to this world. And so all the terms used in the Bible are only relevant to this world, or sometimes they'll even go to the point of saying this universe, but you need to recognize that they don't believe there's only one universe. They believe that there are many universes, plural. And so they will limit all these words to having reference only to this particular creation so as to leave room for not only the progression of God, the status of Godhood, but the fact that Mormon leaders have said from the beginning that if you take a million worlds like this world and number the particle of matter in those worlds, you'll see that there are more gods than there are particles of matter in those worlds. And so Mormonism is the most polytheistic religion that I know of, and so they have to redefine the language to allow for that kind of a thing. Now, I don't know which Mormons necessarily you might be talking with or what their background is, but you do need to realize that there is there's change afoot, but it's more public relation change than anything else right now. That is, Gordon Hinckley, when he became the prophet, had spent over 30 years in the public relations department of the church, and so he knew how to spin things. So when he's been on Larry King, for example, he's known how to de-emphasize things that would make the Mormons look bad and emphasize things that would make the Mormons look good and so on and so forth. Combine that with what's been going on at BYU, where there has been a purposeful, orchestrated attempt over the past 25 years to get their people into non-LDS schools, get non-LDS doctorates and non-LDS training. Well, they want to do that to enhance the status of Mormonism, but it's had, I think, from their perspective, a rather unexpected result, and that is these people come back to BYU, and they're bringing all sorts of different ideas that were never a part of the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s Mormonism.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Of Utah. And
yeah.
So you're getting people at BYU who are trying, I think it's an impossible task, to be perfectly honest with you, but they are trying to carve out for themselves amongst non-LDS philosophers, non-LDS theologians, non-LDS secular scholars. They're trying to carve out for themselves a niche, get respect for themselves.
Yeah.
And as a result, there's, on the part of some, almost a wholesale redefinition of the terms that, when Joseph Smith used them, when Brigham Young used them, when the prophets used them, there was no question what they meant by them. But that stuff just doesn't work. I mean, you cannot turn Joseph Smith into a person who really had a scholarly insight into what was going on. His gross mistranslation of the Book of Abraham, for example, is embarrassing. You've got to start using parable and metaphor and to try to come up with something like this. I don't know if you saw the clip that I played on the blog just a few weeks ago, but I played a cross-examination, and I think, now to think about it, I think tomorrow the next portion of that cross-examination between myself and Dennis Potter is actually scheduled to appear on the blog, so you might find that interesting.
Okay, all right.
But, I'm sorry?
No, that's fine. No, I'll listen to it and see.
It sounds to me like what's happening with BYU
is what's happening in Catholicism. Like a lot of liberals are trying to come along and change things and kind of redefine things. And, when you were talking about that, it kind of made me think of what's going on a lot in Catholicism among at least the liberals.
And that's been going on a lot longer in Catholicism than it has amongst the Mormons, to be sure. But, yeah, there almost always is some sort of a strain between what might be called the Orthodox religious leadership and the universities of a particular religious movement,
yeah.
And that's what you're having take place with BYU. And there is, honestly, I've detected many times a dismissive arrogance on the part of some BYU scholars toward the general authorities of the Mormon Church. They look at them as uneducated men, and obviously when you think about Mormonism, that is an inherent element of the LDS faith, is to distrust worldly learning and rely solely upon the charismatic spiritual experiences of men like Joseph Smith, who himself was greatly unlearned. And so it's odd to see the same kind of conflict developing within Mormonism. And where it's going to go, I don't know, because I can assure you, there are Mormons, many of those Mormons in those exceptionally LDS towns in southern Utah or around Manti, have no interest in following the BYU scholars down the liberal road of becoming just another denomination.
Okay.
And so I don't know where the LDS leadership's going to go and how they're going to be able to deal with all these things. But as it stands right now, when you go through the LDS temple and you enter into the celestial room and you sit around enough to one place on earth where you can discuss the endowment ceremonies and you can discuss the temple, what goes on in the temple and things like that, there is still a tremendous amount of discussion of exaltation to Godhood. You've just seen representations made to you of the plurality of gods, and all of this is meant to be illustrating for you how you can become a god yourself. And mm-hmm. within that context, that's still a very much a part of the LDS faith. But in its external discussions with others, it has become greatly diminished.
And
so as far as the term everlasting is concerned, they would there are some at BYU today who would try to find a way to make that term actually have meaning within Mormonism that would be related to the historic meaning of the term eternal. But they just, Joseph Smith's theology is too clear within the context in which it was stated to honestly look at yourself in the mirror and say, yeah, this is what he intended. So they're having to develop these paradigms very carefully, because obviously, it was only 10, 15 years ago that the church moved against a number of BYU-type scholars who were just getting too liberal for them. So there's an uneasy truce there. But I think the emphasis is still that direction. And so
can I ask a question? If I were to go to their website and do a search on the Doctrine of Covenants and the word everlasting, that's where the evolution takes place in Smith's writings, right? That the everlasting kind of takes on a different slant.
Right. You'd be able to see even within the Doctrine of Covenants, because remember, the Doctrine of Covenants represents revelations
later on,
specifically in regards to Joseph Smith, that are in the earliest portion contemporaneous with the writing of the Book of Mormon and the founding of the LDS Church in the 1830s, April 6, 1830, for the beginning. And then the later ones come much, much longer after that. And he's trying to put together this massive shift that has taken place in his own teaching, where he's gone from being basically a modalistic Trinitarian, because if you read Mosiah chapter 15, it's very obvious in the Book of Mormon, he's trying to express the doctrine of the Trinity, but he does so in error. He does so in a modalistic fashion.
Well, it seemed like in that
shifting.
Yeah, it seemed like in the book. Yeah, it seemed like that in the Book of Mormon that he's almost a Trinitarian. I mean, when you read it, there's some things that he says that you kind of say, well, where, you know, there seemed to be a shift later on with this many gods, but he talks about the Father and the Son being one God. And so I kind of found that interesting.
And not only that, but it creates all sorts of problems. One of which you can actually utilize in helping to witness to a Mormon, and that is, if they believe in the first vision, I don't know if you've seen online my book, Letters to a Mormon Elder. We're actually putting that back in print because there's so much interest in this subject as well. But I document the fact that the first vision story found in LDS scripture, which supposedly takes place in the spring of 1820, simply didn't take place in the spring of 1820. And Joseph Smith's own writings indicate that this is the case. This is the story that developed about 1838, and this is where he allegedly saw God the Father and Jesus Christ as separate and distinct personages. You can go to Doctrine and Covenants section 84, and you can demonstrate that in Joseph Smith's writings at that point in time in DNC 84, which is, if I recall correctly, somewhere in the early 1830s. I don't have a DNC in front of me. He says that no man can see God the Father without the priesthood and live. Now think about it. According to LDS theology, Joseph Smith received the priesthood, the Aaronic priesthood from John the Baptist, and then the Melchizedek priesthood from Peter, James, and John in 1829, 1830. And yet, according to the later story, he saw God the Father in the spring of 1820, 9 to 10 years earlier. And so you can see right there in Dr. Jones, section 84, he has not even yet claimed to have seen God the Father and Jesus Christ as separate and distinct individuals. That whole first vision story, which is normally what the missionaries start out with, was something that evolved tremendously over time. And a careful examination of the LDS scriptures bears these things out. And it can be useful in talking with Mormons to know these things, because generally they're going to take their scriptures with them. So if you demonstrate something to them from their own scriptures, even if they won't take other literature from you, they'll take a look at that.
That's wonderful information. I appreciate it very much.
All right. Well, thank you for your call today.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. Yeah, lots of reason right now. I will apologize. I had wanted to have up on the blog, and I will try to maybe tomorrow get a couple more put together for at least next week, but continue the presentation of letting the Mormon leadership speak for themselves in defining the LDS viewpoint, because it has been tremendously disappointing to listen to the utter lack of meaningful discussion of this particular subject on the part of Americans today because of Mitt Romney's presidential run. You know, without getting into politics, I'm sure the man's a very nice man. The problem is we're in essence being told we cannot speak the truth about Mormonism. Mormonism is just another Christian denomination, and this is what the conservatives are saying. This is what the alleged cultural conservatives are saying, is it's bigoted and it's wrong to take the time to actually speak the truth about Mormonism. And so few people have any knowledge of what Mormonism actually teaches, that it is absolutely terrible. And as a result, they want to say, well, look, we don't really care about that stuff. Mitt Romney's a nice guy. He talks about Jesus. That's all that matters to me. And you're being a closed-minded person. Now, of course, at the same time, I've also seen clips, I even posted a clip on my website, of a guy who approached this in the completely wrong way. I mean, to be at a political rally and stand up in an audience question and basically say you don't believe in God is sheer stupidity, because you don't have time to define what it is you're talking about. But certainly within the ministry of the church, certainly within teaching, certainly within the Sunday school, In the conversations we have with one another, seeking to encourage one another in the faith, after services, whatever, there should be a clear understanding of the actual teachings, the official teachings of the Mormon Church. And this is an opportunity to do so. Someone in channel just said, if you can get your book back into print, just change the title, Is Mitt Romney My Brother? You'll make a fortune. Well, you know what? She's exactly right. There's absolutely no question about it.
I'm going to get the guys over at the bookstore to start drawing up a cover for it right now. we can get pictures from the debate the other night, you know?
That's all you got to do. You know, we can get hold of Mike pretty quick, change title, and Is Mitt Romney My Brother? Yeah, I'll just change the introductory chapter, and we'll be ready to go. Oh, goodness. That's right, though. That would sell like hotcakes. What's that? Oh, there you go. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, letters to a presidential candidate. That one actually came from a certain Mr. Hunt in the UK in Channel, which Mr. Roger here knows who that is. So, yes, letters to a presidential candidate would work fairly well, too. So, and then someone just asked, what kind of a name is Mitt anyway? Someone who very much likes baseball, I think. I don't know where that one came from. Romney, of course, is a good Mormon name. There's no question about that. But Mitt is not a big name. That's Alma or something like that is much more of a good LDS name than anything else. So, there really does need to be, though, much more discussion of this subject within our culture. Now, very quickly, since I'm looking at the watch here and we've got just a few minutes left, and I'm sure there's just all sorts of numbers calling the number right now. But what I was going to mention at one point earlier, before I saw that we had a call, is I'm going up to Scotland, And I can't wait to be in Scotland with my friends and all of my relatives from way back. But things in Scotland aren't overly exciting these days. I have the BBC edition of the Scottish BBC edition on my RSS reader, and I saw a fascinating story. It was one of the top stories in Scotland today. I want to read it to you, and I hope you all are excited as all my Scottish friends are. It says, "Seagull lays egg on roof of car." It says, I'm reading it. It's from Thursday, May 17th, 2007. This is a confused seagull gave a new meaning to the word hatchback when it nested on the roof of a car at Inverness Airport's long-stay car park. See, car park means it's Scottish because you don't say parking lot. They say car park. The bird was incubating eggs on a bundle of twigs and other debris it had formed on top of the Citroën Berlingo. That's not an overly pretty car, is it? No, Roger's saying, no, it's not a pretty car at all. I've got a picture of it here, too. It says, the specialists were brought in to destroy the nest and the eggs to minimize the risk of bird strikes. Now, is a bird strike what I think it is? The birds hitting people. Oh, wow. Oh, dive bombing them. Okay. I thought it might be something you have to clean off of your car later on. Okay, all right. RSPB Scotland said laws stopping people from disturbing nests were not equipped to deal with that kind of situation. It says that George Mayer, 66, from Portinochy, who knows? It's Scottish Portinochy, was shocked to discover the nest and took a photograph. And you all want, you should look this up. It's fascinating. And I was just walking past and thought I had to take a picture, he said. And so there you have it is so wonderful. All this time, Rich has been telling me that he's hanging up on me. He's going to turn it off. We're out of time, he says. I'm not making
it. Yeah,
it up.
It's definitely time to go now.
It's time to go now.
Yeah, it's time to go now.
But I checked my watch with your voice. At the beginning of the program, are you telling me that your countdown can sometimes be a little bit inaccurate?
Well, I have to admit, I did tell you no British accents.
You didn't say anything about a Scottish accent, did you?
Oh, my goodness.
I talked with my good friend Jim Handyside today in Glasgow, and it's just like it just automatically came back how you're supposed to speak when you're in Scotland.
Uh-huh.
That's
very nice.
William Wallace.
That's very nice.
What's wrong? It's a Scottish story. I had to read it as
hang
a
in, folks. Closer comes in 10 seconds.
10 seconds for the closer. Well, he's telling everybody about it. Just to hang on.
Three, two, one.
Two.
Here it comes. There
well,
it
thank
is.
Thank you for listening to The Dividing Line today, live from London. Would you like to do an all-Scottish one next week there, Rich?
Well, yeah, Rich? We got to go now.
You got to go now. Well, thanks for listening to The Dividing Line. We'll see if we can convince Rich to allow us to do a Scottish Dividing Line sometime next week. Maybe, who knows. But thanks for listening. We'll see you later. Bye.
This moment is so far away. We must contend for the
Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracks. Join us again this Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m. for The Dividing Line.